morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, November 20, 2018. An analyst warns investors to think twice before signing oil contracts in South Sudan.
The opportunity might be high. The question is whether companies are willing to take the risk. And there is a lot of risk, though, but I think the investment opportunity is there in the fact that there is a lot of oil under the ground, but you just need to have the appetite for the risk to actually come in and get it.
And a new book tells readers to avoid stereotypes about South Sudan.
But it's also wrong to take away, you know, that hope and optimism that this time something may change. Because I think, you know, people, all the South Sudanese I speak to, my friends, you know, they're exhausted from war. They don't want this to continue. And I think the leadership believe the same.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A senior policy analyst with Africa Risk Consulting Firm in London says companies interested in investing in South Sudan's oil industry should think twice before doing so. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Sean Robert Dutty says the peace deal signed in Khartoum will not silence the guns immediately or improve the country's economy, which depends on oil revenue. Dutty says the peace agreement gives some glimpse of hope, but many foreign oil companies are still watching to see if the business environment is safe.
I think oil companies are a bit wary after that, from the initial jubilation to basically the civil war in 2013, 2016, and now it's paused again. But I think there, and I've spoken to a couple oil companies in Africa as well, and asked them, you know, are you interested in South Sudan? And they said bluntly, no, it is something that's not, we're not looking at. And I asked them why, and the reason why is just the risk is high, and yes, the opportunity might be high. The question is whether companies are willing to take the risk. And there is a lot of risk, though. But I think the investment opportunity is there in the fact that there is a lot of oil under the ground. But you just need to have the appetite for the risk to actually come in and get it.
According to the latest bulletin from the United States Bureau of Economic and Business Affairs, trade and investment conditions in South Sudan are not favorable to U.S. companies. The Bureau says the government has tight control over foreign currency, the country's legal system is ineffective, its infrastructure is limited, and the political risk is high. The state-run China National Petroleum Corporation owns a 40% stake in South Sudan's biggest oil field and has invested billions in oil-related infrastructure. Dutty claims Total and Shell are keeping away from investing in South Sudan because of lack of accountability and human rights violations in the conflict.
One of the issues is the reputational risk, that a lot of the oil money that's been used has been used to buy weapons and has been used to fuel the conflict. And I think for a Western company, that kind of reputational risk of being seen as not just maybe willing to invest in the conflict, but almost helping the conflict, is a reputational risk that they won't have. I think Shell is probably at their end in the Niger Delta. You know, they don't want to be seen as a bad guy anymore. They're trying to improve their reputation. And that is probably one of the major reasons why they're not coming in. Compared to the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, they don't have that pressure from civil society of accountability of what are you doing in that country.
Dutty says oil companies willing to invest in South Sudan's oil and gas should be prepared to face high risk.
You have legislative instability. You know, are oil changes going to happen? Are they going to change the oil code to make it harder to get your money out? Are the royalties going to go up? Are tax regimes going to go up? And, I mean, this is a very real risk.
South Sudan holds Africa's third largest oil reserves, estimated at 3.5 billion barrels. The country was producing 350,000 barrels a day in 2011, after seceding from Khartoum, leaving Sudan with only 25% as oil transit fees. An oil shutdown in early 2011, followed by the outbreak of conflict in 2013, affected production capacity. In March, South Sudan was producing only 135,000 barrels a day, losing over $4 billion of oil revenues, or about up to 95% of its total revenue, before the civil war broke out in 2013. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A British journalist, Peter Martel, has written a new book entitled Raise the Flag, How South Sudan Won the Longest War but Lost Peace. In the book, Martel describes how South Sudan became independent from the British colonial rule in the 1950s and discovered oil later in the 70s. Martel tells Carol Van Damme history cannot be forgotten when trying to solve South Sudan's current problems.
As a journalist, it's very easy to stand on the sidelines and criticize, but to actually come up with a solution or suggestions of what can be done is a much harder question to answer. But I mean, I think as a journalist and as someone who has most recently been reading the long history of South Sudan and writing about it, the lessons that I learned from that was that any solution, the quick fix solutions that are sometimes brought in, they can help, they can alleviate the immediate symptoms. Problems will require enormous efforts over long periods of time. And often the outside forces that come in to provide help, often we forget that this is not necessarily the first time that this peace effort has been tried, or this aid effort, or this development movement has been tried. But, South Sudan has seen so many different people coming in to try and help, often with the very, very best of intentions, but sometimes, that through no fault of their own necessarily can prolong or worsen the conflict. So my answer, I suppose, is, there is no quick fix, but in the end, this will be about community to community. It'll be about the South Sudanese themselves building their own country, building their own communities, and then establishing peace between themselves.
I have heard the argument made that this latest revised peace agreement, the revitalized peace agreement that was signed in Khartoum in September, really doesn't solve their problems either, because it more or less segregates the country up into pieces, like a tribal kind of leadership, which means if you belong to a minority tribe in a certain area, you're going to be on the outs. How do you feel about this latest revitalized peace agreement?
It's very easy to be critical of this latest peace agreement, just based on the most recent years of peace agreements that have so spectacularly collapsed before. And so, yes, as an outsider, it's very easy to say, the likelihood that this one will succeed is slim. But it's also wrong to take away, that hope and optimism that this time something may change. Because I think, people, all the South Sudanese I speak to, my friends, they're exhausted from war. They don't want this to continue. And I think the leadership believe the same. Whether they can hold this deal together, or even if they do hold it together, can it actually translate into a meaningful peace on the ground is another question. And I think, it's right that people will be nervous about this peace agreement. But, at this point in time, the only thing that can be done is to try and support it. But certainly, the sense of that, will it succeed? I would have my deep doubts, but I always remain, supportive and hopeful that it might, because, South Sudan needs a chance. It's been since 2013, December 2013, the war has done so much damage to the people and to the country. So that any chance of the top leadership sitting down to discuss their disagreements more peacefully, it has to be seen as a positive step.
That's journalist and author Peter Martel, who has covered South Sudan for many years. Martel has written a new book entitled Raise the Flag, How South Sudan Won the Longest War but Lost the Peace. His book is available on Amazon.com. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme from Nairobi. Many people in Rwanda complain that when they call the National Police emergency toll-free lines and they can't get help. Some say when you call the numbers, the agent who answers directs the caller to several other numbers, and often those numbers still don't send help. The National Police pledged to do check on the complaints and correct what could be a life-threatening problem. Eugene Wimana has more from Kigali.
This is Mali Louise Aimana, a Rwandan journalist. She's explaining how a woman called her as the second option because the police could not be reached when a teenager had been beaten by her employers. The woman did not want to go to the police station to protect her anonymity. The woman said she feared the local leaders and the employers were friends. Wizaimana says it was over the weekend and the woman called the emergency number, but the police told her to call again on that Monday. When she called on Monday, the police told her to go to the nearest station, even if she insisted that the local police and leaders were accomplices. She called expecting an immediate rescue from the police. Mwari Jones Williams lives in Kigali. He says the emergency toll-free lines seem to have many problems.
When you call them, they tell you, call this number. They give you any other number to call. When you miss a service, say you go back to the toll-free number, then they tell you, call this number again. You call another number, two, three or four numbers, or even eight numbers. If you don't have any response, you still have to go back to the toll-free number. Those are toll-free lines. If you have an urgent issue, a quick service you need, you are in trouble, you can't get served until you get someone to help you.
The Inspector General of Police, Danny Munyuza, says this has to stop. He pledges to investigate to find the cause of the problem so it can be rapidly addressed and keep public trust in the police. The Inspector General says it is not acceptable. Normally, a police officer who receives the call has to connect you with the standby station officers for a quick help. He says these lines are to effectively serve the people who urgently need help. The National Police has 8 short special toll-free lines for different types of emergencies, such as 112 for general emergencies and 111 for fires. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
From Kigali, we move to Monrovia, where the acting top sergeant major for Armed Forces of Liberia says he's concerned about terrorists in neighboring countries spilling into his country. Command Sergeant Major Karamo Duke Freeman says the worrisome terrorism developments outside Liberia must be deterred with additional forces. He spoke in an exclusive interview with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
We have to keep focus and we have to set deterrent so that it don't spread out to our country. Yes, it's kind of worrisome. We ask our partners to get involved immediately so that we curtail the situation.
The UN peacekeeping mission that helped develop Liberia's military withdrew earlier this year. However, Liberia still receives support from the United States and African countries such as Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Ghana, and Benin. The Chinese military influence also seen in the country. Freeman described China as logistics partner, but says its role is limited.
No, we don't work with the Chinese military. They run our assistance in terms of logistics support at time, some earth-moving equipment.
Freeman said his army would suffer if the U.S. military aid to Liberia is cut off, especially in the area of training. He noted the close relationship between the two forces.
Because our army is the offspring of the United States. We originated our doctrine, our tradition, our culture. It's all America-oriented.
That was Liberia's Command Sergeant Major Karamo Duke Freeman speaking with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babbs. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at pneumonia cases in South Sudan. Stay tuned for that story.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
does international assistance help or hurt African communities in the long run?
International assistance helped African countries, especially donor agencies like UNICEF, WHO, in the areas of immunization, pregnant women, and child health development.
Assistance for African countries in the long run will hurt the countries because it will not make them to be able to fight and stand and be independent.
It doesn't help because at the long run, they will bring some policies. You must adopt these policies after they give you their assistance. So I don't think it will help African countries.
I don't know so much about international assistance, but I think for a short time it does help, and yes, it does hurt in the long run.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. In our Tuesday Health segment, we take a look at pneumonia in South Sudan. Doctors at Juba Teaching Hospital say nearly 20 patients are diagnosed with pneumonia every week in the clinical chest referral department. Last week was World Pneumonia Week, and in South Sudan, Dr. Jomsuk Abdallah says pneumonia affects mainly children and the elderly. Winnie Chirino files this report for VOA from Juba.
54-year-old Selina Kikoi sits on a bench outside the doctor's office to seek treatment for pneumonia. Kikoi says in the past 6 days, she received treatment for malaria and typhoid but did not see improvement. Kikoi says 3 days ago, her condition became worse at night and relatives took her to the hospital.
I was having cough, severe cough, dry. So I got treated with cough syrup. It is still continuing. Before 2 days, last night but one, I began to cough what? Blood. So one side of my, the right side of my right side was congested. I could not even breathe. I could not even move. So it was so painful. Then I was brought to the hospital, to Freedom International Hospital. The X-ray was done, ultrasound was done, but they found there's something in the X-ray. There are some fluid in the lungs. So these people decided to treat me with benzyl penicillin.
Kikoi says doctors at the Freedom International Hospital in Juba told her to take a sample of her saliva for screening. She says results of the tests showed she had pneumonia infection. Dr. Kojomsuk Abdallah, a consultant chest physician at Juba Teaching Hospital, says pneumonia can be contracted through contaminated air or bacteria-contaminated droplets.
From the beginning, it is dry cough, and then it becomes purulent. Purulent, that means pus or pussy or greenish in color, and then sometimes also it can be painted with the mild mucoid blood. And then also there is fever, and chest pain, rigor. And then the signs also, a doctor can deduce the other signs and symptoms of signs of consolidation. That is when you put your stethoscope, you can hear like bronchial breathing, we say. And then we ask for X-ray also.
Abdallah cautions people against spitting in the open. He says to prevent the spread of pneumonia infection, people should avoid overcrowded places.
Most of the pneumonias, it comes after infection with the influenza or flu. So protection of flu first, that is you vaccinate people with the vaccines. That is for influenza viruses, especially influenza A. And because after the infection with influenza, one can contract the bacteria, that is streptococcus pneumonia or pneumococcus pneumonia. And then one has to, to wash the hands periodically. That is especially when you go to the toilet and then after coming from the bath. And then also one has to quit from if you are a smoker, because these are the predisposing factors also.
Abdallah says he sees at least 3 pneumonia patients in his private clinic and about 20 at Juba Teaching Hospital per week. He warns that pneumonia is a killer disease.
Most of cases of pneumonia is being treated in the clinics because they just, everybody who coughs, who has got chest pain, he just goes to nearby clinic. That's why in the hospital they don't come to the hospital. Those who are coming to the hospital, these are very sick patients with a very high-grade fever and with severe pneumonia. And even there is a difference between pneumonia and TB. Though TB is a type of pneumonia, but it is a chronic pneumonia because we have also TB pneumonia.
Dr. Luca Bonoja is a pneumonia technical specialist at Save the Children in South Sudan. He calls on the Ministry of Health and other aid agencies to support pneumonia programs.
In South Sudan, up to 20.4% of under 5 mortality are attributable to pneumonia. Pneumonia's under 5 deaths are more than malaria, diarrhea, and measles mortality combined in the same age group. And yet you realize that, the Global Fund is funding malaria, the WHO is funding diarrhea, and somebody else is funding measles, and nobody is funding pneumonia, which kills 3 times as much as any of these diseases.
World Pneumonia Day and World Pneumonia Week are meant to bring people together from across the world to focus on improving ways to deal with the illness. It was first marked in 2009. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Still on health matters, most healthy children between the ages of 4 and 10 grow about 5 centimeters or 2 inches a year. So one family knew something was wrong when their son fit into the same clothes season after season. VOA's Carol Pearson reports doctors were able to get him growing once again after testing for a growth hormone.
All in on three, one, two, three, all in!
11-year-old Spencer Bayman is passionate about baseball.
My goal is to play college baseball.
There was only one problem. Spencer was the shortest player on his team.
I want to be as tall as these kids.
Go, Spencer!
Gradually, Spencer's parents suspected something was wrong.
It really set in one year coming out of winter into spring when he got out his cleats for spring baseball and he put them on, they fit. And they never should have fit. Those were from the spring prior.
Spencer's parents set up an appointment with Dr. Bert Bachrach, the chief of pediatric endocrinology at University of Missouri Healthcare. After careful testing, Dr. Bachrach determined a growth hormone deficiency was causing Spencer's growth failure.
Growth hormone just doesn't affect your growth. It affects your muscle mass and fat distribution. So that affects your cholesterol. That affects your overall, it also affects your overall sense of well-being.
Growth hormone insufficiency is a disorder involving the pituitary gland, which is a small, pea-sized gland located at the base of the brain. It is this gland that produces human growth hormone, among others.
Ready?
Yeah.
Since Spencer started getting a daily hormone injection 2 years ago, he has grown about 15 centimeters. Still, he has a reminder written in each of his baseball caps.
It says HDMH, which means height doesn't measure heart.
And heart is something Spencer has plenty of. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
From health issues, we move to music, where musicians and artists from around Africa met in Nairobi last week to deliberate on issues affecting the continent's music industry. The participants to the meeting, dubbed Music in Africa Conference, came from more than 50 countries, among them composers, singers, trainers, and experts from the music industry from across the world. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports for VOA.
Sion Olota is a Nigerian musician.
Being a musician in Africa, we have a lot of inspiration, we have a lot of talented guys, but our works don't get to be well exhibited. Reason being that mutually mobility, sponsorship, people will sponsor pageants, but when it's time to put money on music, on cultural projects, it becomes an issue. And one is affecting the continent in terms of archiving, that storing history, because musicians, artists, we archive history, we store history.
Recently, hundreds of musicians, composers, singers, and producers from around the world gathered in Nairobi for the second annual Music in Africa conference. Eddie Atitie is the director of the Music in Africa Foundation, a Johannesburg-based non-profit group that organized the conference.
The motivation that is pushing us to create this event is really to create a sustainable African music sector or industry, to facilitate growth, to create jobs for musicians, to create connections between music players, not only within Africa but also with the international community. That's why we are bringing everyone from all over the world to come here, spend some time, and to connect, to learn, and to engage.
Rapper Kang JJ is from South Sudan, the world's youngest nation.
This simply means grow in peace. It's about inner peace. That if you really want real peace, get closer to God. Because when you get closer to God, there are dark things that you cannot see as a normal being. But when you are closer to God, you will see those.
Moro Lokombu is a radio producer with United Nations Radio in South Sudan. He explains the challenges facing musicians in his country, where hundreds of thousands have lost their lives in years of civil conflict.
South Sudanese musicians are facing difficulties in terms of recording, to begin with recording fees. We know very well that the economy of South Sudan is not doing well up to this moment. Fuel is scarce. For that matter, it has become very expensive. Electricity is not so much in South Sudan, so people mostly rely on generators, which need fuel to run. So recording fees have hiked because of that. Artists who are based in other parts of the region, which is outside the capital, face difficulties in terms of accessing the capital city because most of the best facilities are in the capital city.
During the three-day conference, participants were treated to live performances, panel discussions and exhibitions. Maya is with a Kenyan band called Maya and the Big Sky.
My name is Maya from Maya and the Big Sky, and I'm a Kenyan musician. The music, I'm calling it Afrosonic Soul. It's a bit of everything. And we sing in Kiswahili, but we also sing in English. At this moment in time, it's really exciting. I think there seems to be like now this bubbling that's happening, which I think was there in the 60s. It was there potentially at the beginning of the 70s, and now is the time. Everyone is kind of looking to Africa and East Africa also.
The event was organized in collaboration with the German Cultural Center, Goethe Institute, and Siemens Foundation. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with a traditional Avokaya song from Tore County in Yei River State. We have been listening to a traditional Avokaya song from Tore County in Yei River State. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Let's know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also get us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.
Yeah.